Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine brings you public policy lectures, debates, and panel discussions from across Maine. Today, we take you to Northport, Maine for a meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. The speaker is Ambassador Stephen E. Steiner, gender advisor for the U.S. Institute of Peace. He previously served in the Department of State's Office of Global Women's Issues and the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Washington Institute on Foreign Affairs, and the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council, and he serves on the board of the Council for a Community of Democracies. The program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org, where it is available for streaming and for podcasting. Introducing our speaker today is Mac DeFord, president of the forum.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the August meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983. By a small group of area residents with a special interest in U.S. foreign policy and our role in international affairs. We meet on a monthly basis to hear retired foreign policy officials, academics, journalists, and international businessmen discuss important foreign policy issues. Our membership, which is currently about 250, includes not just those who are interested in foreign affairs, but as well many who have lived and worked abroad and have considerable expertise about many of the issues discussed. For additional information, please visit our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker Ambassador Stephen Steiner. He's the gender advisor for the U.S. Institute of Peace. He previously served in the Department of State's Office of Global Women's Issues and the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. He also is the director of the Department's Iraqi Women's Democracy Initiative. Ambassador Steiner served in the Foreign Service for 36 years and was awarded the Secretary of State's Distinguished Service Award when he retired in 2002. Born in Pennsylvania, he received a BA in political science from Yale in 1963, a master's degree in international relations from Columbia in 1966. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Washington Institute on Foreign Affairs, and the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council. And he serves on the board of the Council for a Community of Democracies. We're delighted to have him today to discuss his topic, Building Peace Through the Empowerment of Women in Post-Conflict Countries. Ambassador Steiner.
Thank you, Mac. It's really a pleasure to be here for both my wife, Merle, who's sitting there, and myself, and we have some old friends here who actually helped arrange this, George and Karen Look, with whom I worked for many, many years on arms control issues, particularly nuclear arms negotiations with the old Soviet Union, and then with the successor states of the Soviet Union that inherited the nuclear weapons, which were Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. A word on my personal background is, as Max said, I spent 36 years in the U.S. Foreign Service, and at some point during that career, and particularly because I'd had experience in Moscow and I spoke Russian at the time, I was sort of recruited to go into political military work, which is what we call defense and arms control issues at state. And I ended up doing that for a long, long time and doing nuclear arms negotiations for about the last 12 years of my Foreign Service career. Getting out only when I retired from the Foreign Service. But when I retired from the Foreign Service after 36 years, I started what I call my second career because I totally switched gears on subject matters and started doing democracy and human rights work, still at the State Department, for another 7.5 years. And working on democracy and human rights issues there led me very quickly to women's rights and women's empowerment, and I got very involved with that. I was doing this during the George W. Bush administration, and Condi Rice, the Secretary of State at the time, used to like to say that half a democracy is not a democracy. And I think she's absolutely right. Any country that empowers only half of its people, and particularly does not empower politically, economically, socially, the female half, is not going to be a very successful or well-governed or civilized country. So I spent almost 8 more years at state working on those issues, and I also spent part of that period, as Max said, working on human trafficking issues. I went over to do that on purpose. I mean, I was already a retiree, so you know, I could sort of pick and choose what I wanted to do, because I wanted to learn more about human trafficking. And I certainly learned what a scourge that is around the world. The magnitude of it is just devastating, with millions and millions of people around the world in some kind of forced or child labor or sexual slavery. And you're hearing again about sexual slavery because of what ISIS is doing in Syria and Iraq. And my particular bailiwick there was leading our efforts at the State Department to counter labor trafficking, which means forced labor and child labor. And that's in itself an issue of tremendous magnitude around the world, with issues that affect us here, such as child labor in the cocoa industry in countries like Ghana and the Ivory Coast, and forced labor in the shrimp and fishing industries in countries like Thailand, from which at least at that time I know we were importing over $4 billion just of shrimp a year. And the particular issue there was how the Thai treated Burmese who escaped across the border from that terrible regime and then ended up, for example, with their documents taken away and in forced labor. And one sign of what is human trafficking, one way it's defined, is if a person has had his documents or her documents taken away, that is being trafficked right there because you have lost control over your own destiny. So that is a sign of human trafficking. And these things are just huge issues. Finally, after almost 44 years at the Department of State, I made real progress. I walked across 23rd Street and joined the U.S. Institute of Peace. It's really just across 23rd Street from State. It's a small institution, about 300 people. The main mission is to work to prevent, mitigate, or resolve conflict if conflict does break out, and to promote reconciliation during and after conflict. It was founded by Congress in 1984, an initiative of the Reagan administration, but it's a federally funded. Our central operating budget comes directly from Congress, not through any operating agency, not through any agency. It's nonpartisan, and it's an independent organization. It's a think tank, but it's also a do tank in the sense that we have programs on the ground in conflict countries, a lot of work in Afghanistan, Pakistan, no offices in Berlin or Paris or London, although there's conflict everywhere now, but very involved with Afghanistan, Pakistan, some work in Central Asia. We've been very involved with Colombia, and I have a colleague who has worked hard on the peace negotiations that have just come about in Colombia, and her main work there has been to bring women from various groups, various parts of Colombia into the peace process so that they are there from day one and part of how the peace is implemented and how reconciliation, which will be a huge task, will be brought about. We're also very involved in sub-Saharan Africa, a lot of countries there, very involved with Nigeria and Kenya, for example. My own group, the Gender and Peacebuilding Group, has had a project in Nigeria and Kenya where we're working with women to help them acquire the skills to combat extremist violence. And the way we've started that project, just a note on that, it's interesting to get women from rural areas to come to meet with foreign trainers and foreign organizations. We organize mother schools because even in conservative Muslim communities, most husbands didn't mind their wives coming out for mothers, for training on how to be a good mother. And that was actually done. That was not a ruse. But then we also worked with them to develop skills for them to recognize and combat signs of extremism among young people, particularly men, but also women are an issue now too, in their communities. And at a later stage, we got these women together with male police officers and female police officers too. There were many of them in their communities to work together on how they would recognize and combat the narrative of violent extremism. Now, just imagine in these rural places in particular, you can't get women out of their homes, bring them into a training, and have them in there with male police officers. That's just not going to work in these societies. So it's a step-by-step process, as is a lot of this work. People have asked me how I can go from nuclear arms negotiations to working on women's empowerment. And I have a simple answer. My connecting theme is that we really feel, I mean, George and Karen will attest to this, that in doing, bringing down nuclear arms in a verifiable way with real inspections, we are creating a safer world. And I really feel also that in empowering women, particularly in countries that have gone through terrible violent conflict, we're also working to create a safer world. So that's my unifying theme. The first project I took on at the U.S. Institute of Peace was doing a lessons learned best practices exercise on what are the best ways for the international community to try to help empower women in a country that has gone through violent conflict. And the first, we brought together, formed a working group and brought together people from the U.S. government, like the Department of State and the U.S. Agency for International Development, some from the Department of Defense, people from NGOs, civil society, non-government organizations, U.S. and international ones, and quite a few people from foreign embassies in Washington took part too, particularly some of the European countries that do a lot of work themselves to empower women in countries that have gone through conflict, such as the Scandinavians, the British, the Dutch, the Germans, and some others. And also, we did a lot of focusing on countries right away, like Iraq and Afghanistan, which not only have gone through terrible conflict, but I feel, a lot of us feel that we have a special moral responsibility to try to help people in those countries. So embassies of those countries also took part with us in this programming. And we formed a community of practice doing this work. I went around and interviewed a lot of organizations that have done work on the ground, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan, to ask them what worked and what hasn't worked in your efforts to empower women. And what do you think are the best practices? What do you think are the worst practices? And one purpose is just to try to get people to talk to each other, to compare notes. What are you doing? So we're not all, you know, we don't have 20-some organizations training the same people or creating trips to the U.S. for the same people, so that we hopefully think about what we're doing and get beyond urban elites, because there's such a predilection to go after urban elites, English-speaking urban elites and capitals, which is the easiest thing to access, but the people will probably need this the least. So we just, and we try not to duplicate each other too. So we did a report on this with the lessons learned and best practices laid out. And I think on some of your tables, there's a one pager on some of our work, and you'll see the lessons learned exercise down on the bottom left. And we published this on International Women's Day, May 8th in 2012. And then as a second phase in this program, trying to develop, you know, get farther on what are the best ways to design programs to empower women in these violent countries, we started bringing together women leaders from these countries. And as a neutral, safe place to do it, we used Turkey to bring them together. It may not be the best place right now, but it was a very good place then to bring people together, and much easier, especially when you recognize that getting visas to the U.S. is a very difficult thing now. And even on programs sponsored by our government, sponsored by U.S. organizations, it's sometimes very hard to get women in, men too, for these programs. So Turkey was a place that was easier to get people in from countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. And what we wanted to do with these programs was get the women themselves to tell us what has worked, in your opinion, what has not worked in trying to get you empowered in the political field, in the economic field, and socially in your country, and how can we, you know, from the outside, Western organizations, do the best job of working with you to meet your agenda, to do it the way you think it should be done in your country, and not bring in our own recipes, which often would be bound to fail in some of these difficult and very patriarchal societies. And I mean really patriarchal. We did that first with Iraqi and Afghan women leaders, small sectors. And then we did it a second one with women from the Arab Spring, as well as Iraqis and Afghans. And we had some women from Tunisia and Libya. And we helped them to develop common strategies and to share notes with each other on how they can achieve political office, achieve economic success, be in the media, be socially active, get higher educations, get advanced degrees, how they can be a factor in their countries, particularly as their countries try to get out of their war situation and start building what would hopefully be a sustainable peace. And we found that these women from the four countries, which are very different in many ways, Afghanistan, Iraq, Tunisia, which is in North Africa, Libya, also North Africa. They had some really major concerns that were just totally shared in common. One was their own safety and security, and the safety and security of their families too. And the more activists they were, the more interested in upholding their rights they were, the more dangers they could face to their security and that of their family. And some of them had been subjected to terrible threats. Second concern was that there'd be a major rollback of what rights they already had, you know, which were limited, but there were some, and they were afraid of a major rollback. I'll give Egypt as an example where, as you know, there was a democratic sort of revolution against the Mubarak regime. Women were out in the streets then with men leading this democratic revolution, and they were appreciated and respected at that moment. But once Mubarak was overthrown, and they had a new regime, I'm not going to go into the Morsi regime, because it isn't totally because of that. But once the dictator was overthrown, that political objective was achieved, women were basically pushed back from the streets. And I mean pretty literally. They weren't welcome there. In fact, it was dangerous for them to go there. And Egypt in particular, and even Cairo itself, has a really bad record on harassment and attacks on women in public spaces. So they basically were no longer welcome in the public spaces. And the typical answer they're giving when they complain to men, some of whom they had worked with on the democratic revolution, was, not now, we've got these other priorities. But as one of my Middle Eastern colleagues at the U.S. Institute of Peace, a woman, Muslim, likes to say, when you hear these guys say not now, that means never. So it's totally unacceptable. There is, in fact, now, to help in these situations, a UN Security Council resolution, UNSC 1325. It's 16 years old now. And it mandates, and it is, a Security Council resolution is legally obligatory for UN member states. It mandates that in countries that have gone through conflict, women are at the table to try to stop the conflict and build peace from day one, and that they have and are, you know, help to develop into leadership roles, and that they are there for peace building and reconciliation from the beginning. And one of the useful things about it, I'm going to get back to that, it's called Women, Peace, and Security. And it makes it a security issue for UN member states. And that's useful because it helps to get the attention of men. When men hear security issues, they might be more likely to show up to talk about the role of women, the empowerment of women, and it does sort of broaden the dialogue. And in fact, in my own journey, I think I've gone from what's often called hard security issues, like nuclear arms negotiations, to these so-called softer security issues, like women's empowerment. But it is useful that these things are now labeled security issues. So, excuse me. One of our key lessons learned in this work was, I like to say, men. much more has to be done in these countries that have gone through violent conflict to get men to understand and support the need, for example, in their country's own security and stability interest, the need to empower women, to empower that half of their society. And so we've started to do work now on getting some forums on this and getting work to get men engaged on these issues. Our biggest initiative was in October of 2013 when we held a big symposium with over 200 people at USIP, people from around the world, and it was called Men, Peace, and Security. And we very deliberately named it as the other side of that UN Security Council resolution because our point is that we don't think any country that's gone through violent conflict is going to really succeed in having women at the table, having women play a major role, succeed on carrying out this UN Security Council resolution. And the resolution calls for a national action plan to show how each country is going to carry it out. We don't think any of that will succeed unless there's a very concerted, organized program to involve men to work with women and to support the empowerment of women in these countries. And the theme of our big symposium was men as positive agents of change. what men can do as peace builders and agents of reconciliation in war-torn countries, in building peace and better relations in their families, their communities, and in their countries. And again, we made it clear that this is a security issue, men, peace, and security. We got over 200 people there, including some amazing practitioners, guys already involved in this work in some of the most war-torn countries, from Afghanistan, Pakistan, a lot of about, I counted, I think, 10 sub-Saharan African countries, including South Africa, and guys from the Balkans, Northern Ireland, really an interesting mix. And they were into these issues, and they were into the need to create a peaceful sense of masculinity to, you know, help to bring along this process. And we really did bring together hard and soft security issues in this. For example, one of our keynote speakers at the symposium was General Ray Odierno, who at the time was the Army Chief of Staff for the U.S. and had been the Chief of our Operations in Iraq, and is really a terrific guy on these and other issues. And I think that in doing this, we expanded the scope of what had been traditional gender analysis, and certainly I think helped to make it clear to men that gender just does not just refer to women, but gender involves how the two work together and the relationships among them, boys and girls and men and women all. And, you know, when I started this work at State, often I was in a room that was 50 to 1, 55 to 1. We'd have a delegation of women leaders from somewhere, and sometimes I'd be the only guy. And I looked around and decided, I have to change this. So with this symposium, over 55% were men from around the world, and I think we started to change it. And you'll see in this one pager, up in the upper right-hand corner, something on our Men, Peace, and Security Initiative. And it even gives you a video that you can click onto, a 10-minute video with some of these key men who work these issues from around the world. And some of their comments are very interesting. Now, you'll see in that video the comments made by a lady named Zainab Bangora. She's an African lady, a Muslim, and she is the UN Special Representative for Ending Sexual Violence in Wartime or in Conflict. And she made a really good statement that I always like to quote. And she said, to do this work, you not only have to take the guns out of the hands of the boys, you have to take the guns out of their heads. Because in these conflicts, some really young kids have been dragged in. They're carrying guns. They're sort of made to kill people. I've even read in situations like in some African countries where they're forced back to their own communities and forced to kill people there. Meaning you can never go home. You're their person now. You're their captive. And in some cases, I think it's probably hopeless, but we have learned that in many cases, these kids can be brought around. But you have to work with them psychologically to show that you don't need a gun. You don't need this ability to kill other people, to wreak harm on other people, male or female, to be a man. There are other ways to be a man, to be a real man. And part of this work, part of this methodology is that in these cases, with this training, violence can be unlearned. And that was a new phrase for me, unlearning violence. But this is held to be the case. We're working with a network of NGOs, for example, in the Balkans. And as my friends Bob and Mary there know, the old Yugoslavia was once one country, is now seven countries, and even some little sub-parts of countries that are ethnically different from other parts of them. This is a result of the Balkan Wars of the 90s, where it got to actual genocide in places like Bosnia and Kosovo. and there are terrible, hard feelings left from these conflicts. Hatred still runs high, as I've learned in my recent trips back to that area. These NGOs that we work with, these civil society organizations, are led by young men. They're in all seven of the new countries, and even in some of those so-called sub-state areas. taking Bosnia as an example, I feel rather critical toward the way we, the U.S., brought about peace in the Balkans, and particularly in Bosnia. At Dayton, you'll remember it, was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton in the Clinton administration. A guy, a very talented diplomat named Richard Holbrooke, may he rest in peace, brought them together and actually locked up the leaders of those countries and those ethnic groups until they came out with peace. But we are often, almost always, a very impatient country, and we brought about a pretty fast peace at that point by separating the populations, not by bringing them together in any meaningful way. So what you have in a place like Bosnia is a rather cold peace, where, take for example, the cosmopolitan, once very cosmopolitan city of Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina. It was once a mixture of ethnicities and religions and a really fascinating place. It's now about 90% Muslim because the Croats have moved out to their zone of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is Herzegovina, and Serbs have basically moved to their zones. And one place that's inside Bosnia is called the Srpska Republika, the Serbian Republic, which is not to be confused with with Belgrade, which is the capital of the Republic of Serbia. I know that sounds confusing, but that's a real country, and a country that's making some good steps toward democracy and trying to join Europe. But the Srpska Republika is sort of like Putin's little friend in the Balkans, and it's governed in a very undemocratic and distasteful way. And I'm going to come back to that. Anyhow, these young men's NGOs work with several missions in mind. First of all, to instill in the young men, who you got a picture coming out of their homes, have probably have heard a lot of hatred from one, you know, religious group toward another and ethnic groups. And religion and ethnicity are pretty much the same in the Balkans. Croats tend to be Roman Catholic, Serbs are Eastern Orthodox Christian, and the people they call the Bosniaks are the Bosnian Muslims, which is the majority population of Bosnia. So they work to instill in these young men a peaceful sense of masculinity, respect for girls and women. they train them in ways to recognize and combat gender-based violence, and they train them to recognize and combat all forms of hate speech. And that includes hate speech against girls and women, and that includes hate speech against the other ethnic and religious groups. As you hear in so many countries, the others. I sat down when I was in Zagreb and had a talk with a young male activist who's in one of these NGOs, the one in Zagreb, that's the capital of Croatia. And think about the context. Croatia is now a democracy, even though it had a fascist past in World War II, which has not been forgotten by the Serbs and others. It's now a member of the European Union as well. And it was very meaningful for me to see the Croatian flags, their independent flag, hanging right next to the European Union flag on all the government buildings. That was interesting. So I asked this young guy over coffee, well, one of your aims in your organization is to combat hate speech. In Croatia, who's the hate speech directed against? Well, his answer was four things. He said, first, you can guess, the Serbs. There's a hatred of the Serbs still. They see all responsibility for the Balkan Wars of the 90s resting on the shoulders of the Serbs. And I agree that a lot does, but not necessarily all. And they see Croatia as the victim. That's the way each of them always sees themselves. Secondly, there's hatred against minorities such as the Roma, who, you know, they consider a kind of gypsy. Third, there's religious prejudice against Orthodox and against the Muslims. And fourth, and he said to me, believe it or not, there's still a lot of hate speech against girls and women in Croatia. Democratic, Roman Catholic, member of the European Union. So that's what we're dealing with. And there's trauma that came out of that war, and there's trauma, I guess, that comes out of all wars. And, you know, it's what kids hear, it's what they experience, it's what their elders may have done as well. And this trauma and this hatred is often directed against the others, particularly if you're in a situation, young people, young men, where your economic opportunities are limited, and that is the case in those places, like in Bosnia, even worse in Kosovo, which is another new state there. And you tend to blame it on the others and hold these lingering bad feelings. There's some good news in all this. These groups work very well together across all the seven new national lines and across the sublines as well that were created there, which is not only that little monster of a Srpska Republika within Bosnia, but also the north of Kosovo is overwhelmingly Serbian, whereas Kosovo is 90% Muslim. They're ethnically Albanians. Their religion is Muslim. And there's a group up there, too. I've been in touch with them up in the north and helped them to get a grant from the U.S. Embassy in Pristina, the capital of Kosovo. But they work very well across these new national lines, which, as I said, are pretty much the same as religious and ethnic lines. And the whole association of these groups is called the Budimushko Klubovi, the Be a Man Clubs. And it is about, you know, these young men are training other young men on what they feel is the right way to be a man. This is work being done by CARE International. It's CARE in the Western Balkans. The guy running the program is a guy named John Crownover. He's done great work there for about 10 years now. He actually lives in Banja Luka, the capital of this Serbian enclave inside Bosnia. And we had a forum with him recently. He brought over one of his young Serbian activists, and we had a really good discussion with them. Had a Croatian guy on the podium, too. One of the partners to CARE International is an NGO called Promundo, P-R-O-M-U-N-D-O. You might want to look them up. It was founded in Brazil, and I think it means for the world in Portuguese. And they do wonderful work around the world in training in this peaceful masculinity, and they've developed a very good methodology. And one of the places that we're taking this is Afghanistan. We like a challenge. So some months ago, we started a program for young men in Afghanistan. We define this as for young men between the ages of 19 and 29, because we think that they will be, that generation is the more open-minded and the best hope for bringing about peace there. I went out to Afghanistan myself to do some consultations to shape the program last September, and we talked to a lot of people, Afghans, young and old, male and female, religious and secular, and they all said, oh my God, this is urgent, this is needed. We totally have a culture of violence here. Violence is a norm. It's getting worse, they said, because the economic situation, a lot of young men can't find work, and this makes them desperate, this makes them angry, and this makes them feel that they're not fulfilling their manhood, their male responsibilities, and they often go join violent groups. So in cases like that, it's not ideology, at least not, you know, it's not that they've become Muslim extremists. All these people are Muslim. But it's just that they're frustrated young men, and these groups offer them a group identity and some pretty good money, more money than they've seen, and they go join those groups and they become violent men. And that's one of the problems there. Promundo is our international partner for this. But we're working through NGO partners on the ground in Afghanistan. USIP has about 26 programs in Afghanistan, projects, and this is just one of them. And we're working through a couple Afghan NGOs run by young men who have learned and are doing some work on these themes of peaceful masculinity. And we're training them. And then it's a pilot project, four provinces of Afghanistan. Kabul's one of them. Herat out in the west on the Iranian border. Balk up in the north on the Central Asian borders, and Nangarhar over in the east, which has been infiltrated not only by the Taliban, but ISIS is out there too. And it'll be Afghans doing the training in those other places. The Western trainers won't go beyond Kabul. When I was there, I could feel the insecurity myself. It's a pretty dangerous place. It's gotten even worse now, unfortunately. But I got around pretty well because we're not U.S. government per se, so I was not under embassy rules. USIP, we have our own office there with about 30-some people, mostly Afghans. And we had our own drivers, and we had a nondescript little sedan that we went around with, my colleague who's Afghan-American and I. And our two drivers are very Afghan-looking young guys, no English. One's a security guy, the other's the driver. But our security guys are not armed. I mean, we stay under the radar there. And consequently, we were able to go to a couple universities, to a couple NGOs, to one private home of a former government deputy minister, and to UN headquarters to meet with the UN Women Office in Afghanistan. And we did have a meeting with embassy people as well at the embassy, but behind all these walls and barriers and barbed wire. And after going through all the barriers and barbed wire, there we were sitting around the swimming pool with our embassy colleagues. And they asked, where are you going? What are you visiting? When I started naming the places we're going, and even the place where we stayed, the hotel, I said, I can't go there, I can't go there, I can't go there. So it's really tough on our embassy people there. I mean, they're under such restrictions because security is just a huge issue. So anyhow, this program is going well. We're getting a good reaction so far. The men have all been positive. Even though it's only a two-year pilot, we hope that the men will continue with these positive values and help to make, you know, our accomplishments sustainable by continuing to promote these values in these four provinces of Afghanistan. Of course, what I'd really like is to see more funding for this. The funding has come from USAID, and it would be good to be able to continue it, take it to other provinces as well. It's a pilot. And finally, I want to conclude by going back to Europe, because Europe is not so peaceful these days. And I mean not only what ISIS is doing, but also Putin's work in undermining the entire peace structure of the post-World War II period, in annexing Crimea forcefully, and then invading eastern Ukraine in an area that's called the Donbas, which is a very heavily populated, very industrial area of Ukraine. And they're holding about 14% of Ukraine now, Russian troops and their separatist allies. So we developed a program. We're working with displaced persons in Ukraine, of which there are 1.8 million now. Ukraine, believe it or not, there in Europe, is the fourth largest country in the world for internally displaced persons. That means people have lost their homes, driven out of their homes because of conflict, but they've stayed within the country. They're fourth in the world after Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. So that's quite a distinguished company to be in. So we're trying to help on this by working with displaced persons in three cities: Kiev, a town called Vinnytsia in the south, and a town called North Donetsk, out right outside the conflict, the occupied zone, to give them peace building and reconciliation and leadership skills so that they can show their value to their new communities, because they've not been well integrated. The government isn't doing much for them there, and we want to help to promote social cohesion in Ukraine, because Ukraine is really facing two battles. One is the conflict with the Russians in the east, but the other is bringing about decent governance themselves, democratic governance, fighting corruption, which is a huge plague there. It's a huge plague in Russia, too, and bringing about decent democratic governance. And that's what these people have opted for. In most cases, they emphasize to us they weren't driven out of their homes because their homes were bombed. They came out because of values. They came out because they want to be part of what they hope will be a democratic Ukraine with positive, peaceful values and not part of the Putin regime in Russia. And they took chances to do it. In a lot of cases, these are people in their 30s and 40s who came out because they want their kids educated with positive values. And in many of those cases, their parents, say in their 60s, or older, stayed back in the occupied zone. So families have become separated because of what they're doing to get out of that zone. And as one lady said to us from the Donbas, my mother stayed behind. She wouldn't come with us. She has her mission. Her mission is to protect the home we worked so hard to build, protect the flower, the garden that she worked so hard to grow, and protect the way of life that we had there. But my mission and my husband's mission is to get our kids a decent education and to have them hopefully be part of Europe. So, a lady from Crimea said that she and her husband tried to stay after the Russian occupation of Crimea. They stayed some months. She had a 13-year-old daughter in school. And one day in the school, the kids were doing a kind of show and tell. And remember, this is Crimea now, occupied by Russia. The only media they get now is Russian TV, which is very propagandistic, full of lies. They're cut off from Ukrainian media. And so one day in school, her daughter gets up in a show and tell and says, my mother and my grandmother just visited Lviv. Well, Lviv is a city in western Ukraine near the Polish border. With that, her treatment totally changed in the school. She was never called by her first name again. She was called a fascist or a banderista. That's, you know, the Ukrainian term for a group they considered fascists. or a CIA agent. Boys would make paper planes and write insults and threats on them and throw them at her and hit her. The teachers would do nothing. It was all tolerated. So at that point, the lady said, that's it. We're moving for our kids' sake. and they moved to Ukraine. And then the amazing thing about this is these people are resilient. They're determined. They want to start a new life. In most cases, they're still looking for work. I'd love to find ways to help them. Some of them were entrepreneurs once. They had businesses. And they want to be part of Ukraine. And the amazing thing is, every single person that we encountered from both Crimea and the Donbas, they're Russian speakers. Russian's their preferred language. And they want to be part of Ukraine, okay? A lot of our trainers were speaking Ukrainian. And that was fine. Everybody understood each other fine. They were even putting things on the board in Ukrainian. The displaced persons would ask questions in Russian. Traders would come back in Ukrainian. And they were getting along fine. But, you know, Putin's big theory, his big explanation to the world is he has to be the protector of Russian speakers and of Russian culture because they're being persecuted around the world. He cited the Baltics. He cited Kazakhstan. And he always cites Ukraine. Where Russian speakers, people who want to speak Russian, are being persecuted every day by CIA agents and Ukrainian fascists. Well, this shows what a farce that is. These are all Russian speakers. They want to be part of Ukraine, and they consider themselves Ukrainian. Yet the problem is, one of the problems is, in trying to develop social cohesion, they face really bad stereotypes. Most people in Ukraine, in the center and in the West, still feel that anyone from the East is pro-Russian. And so one of the things they have to overcome is that stereotype, as well as being newcomers in communities where they're not totally welcome. So this has been another interesting experience. And it just shows it's not over in building peace, not even in Europe. Thank you very much. Can I just, one thing I want to do, Mac, before you I take the questions, because you do it by cards, right?
Yes.
I want to tell you a story about Khrushchev, former, leader of the Soviet Union, at the 20th Party Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, where famous, this party congress, because he denounced the crimes of Stalin. And this was the first time that Stalin was dead, had been criticized. And he denounced them in really complete, dramatic terms, all the murders and crimes and the victims of the Stalin regime. And at the end of this long denunciation, he said, "And now I'll take questions." And of course, the system was to get the questions written on cards, and the cards will be brought up. So the cards are brought up to him, and he picks one up, and he says, "Here's an interesting question." And the question is, he reads it, "If it's true, Comrade Khrushchev, that all these things were happening during Stalin's reign, just what were you doing then?" So Khrushchev says, "Very interesting question. With a comrade who asked that question, please stand up." And everybody looks around. Nobody stands up. And so he says again, "Please, with a comrade who asked that question, please stand up." Everybody looks around. There's silence in the room. No one stands up. And he says, "You see, that's what I was doing then."
Well, Steve, if
thank you.
If you get some embarrassing questions, I'll make sure we get the speaker to stand up.
All right, do that.
All right, let me start with this one. This is interesting. Are the Kurdish female fighters accepted as equals by the Kurdish males?
Yeah, that's a fair question. Well, nothing's perfect. I've met with a lot of Kurds. And had meetings with the Kurdish representation office in Washington, which is headed by a woman, and she's brought some delegations of women leaders over. We've talked to them at length. There's still problems in Kurdistan, but Kurdistan is much more democratic and much more friendly to the empowerment of women than other parts of Iraq or other parts of the Middle East. And as I think you all know, the Kurds are certainly our best friends in the region. They've been loyal friends of the United States for a long time. We've helped them too. You know, after the first Gulf War, we imposed a no-fly regime on Saddam's forces for the Kurdish zone because he had persecuted them. He had killed 5,000 in one town alone with chemical warfare. And so we protected them from there on in. So even from that point on, in the early 90s, they started to build their own kind of society. So yeah, women are pretty respected there, and these women fighters are respected, and they're good fighters. So Kurdistan's a very interesting case, and I hope that the Kurds in both Iraq Syria and Turkey come out well from all these wars.
Okay, we've got a couple of questions that relate to religion, and I'll sort of read all three of them. What has your group done to engage the clergy in your target countries? A related one is, isn't Islam opposed to women's rights? Do you deal with imams and encourage them to preach male-female equality? Doesn't advocating empowerment of women immediately put you into conflict with some of the religious establishment?
Okay, wow. Let me go back first to this experts dialogue that we had in Turkey when we brought together women leaders from Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Tunisia, all Muslim countries. And one of the common concerns they had, one of the common problems they faced, was they all said that their religion was being deliberately misinterpreted and misused to put back women's rights. And they knew that this wasn't real Islam, that Islam as a religion is much more tolerant of women, but the guy standing up and opposing women's rights and sometimes putting women out there to oppose them were basically drawing upon tribal and cultural values and not really the religion itself. And so one need they all said they had was they got to get more women trained in the religion, in Islam, in their countries, so they have more women religious scholars who can advance their rights and fight this battle in a more Islamic context. And they cited Morocco as a very good example of a country where there are a lot of women trained in the religion and women with religious roles, and said they'd love to get some training for their women in Morocco. And yes, when I said much more has to be done to reach out to men, I should have said including religious figures, including religious leaders, almost all of whom are men, particularly in those countries. And we do have programs working with imams to establish a dialogue on women's rights under Islam. I have a colleague who does this, for example, in Afghanistan. She's an Afghan-American Muslim, and she's covered. And she's tough. She considers herself an Islamic feminist. And she brings this this dialogue and these precepts to the imams and gets them to understand women's rights, encourages them to speak out in Friday prayers in favor of women's rights. And some of them have really done so well. Others are slower to get the message. One part of the program has been that she's taken some of these male religious leaders from Afghanistan to look at Muslim organizations in countries like Indonesia and Malaysia, which is a much milder form of Islam without some of the harsh cultural traditions, the patronymy that you have in the patriarchalism that you have in Afghanistan. And that has helped to open their eyes to, you know, Islam's a big world. It isn't all like some of these rural guys in Afghanistan have been preaching. And in fact, she's told me, and others have told me, that some of these rural guys are really, to say the least, not very well educated. They just basically bring their own views out there. They don't know Arabic. They can't even read the Quran in its original. And there's a lot more education needed here.
Okay, this one is about jobs. What are the prospects for jobs for these young people? At what point do girls and women have work or a career as an option? And how does empowering your program, how does that work in this regard?
Well, we don't really do economic empowerment per se. We can't create jobs. You know, as I said, like in regard to this Ukraine program, boy, I wish we could help to find some seed money for some of these guys who have been and women who have been entrepreneurs in the areas from which they've been displaced. And they said, you know, I've got the skills. I know how to run a business. I did this or that. Just help me get started again. I'm actually going to reach out to some organizations, try to help them find some seed money, some loans or something to help them get started, because I think that is an excellent way to empower people, both men and women, particularly when they already have these skills and have already known how to run a business. So I think in most of these cases, it's networking, helping them to find the right place to succeed in the economy. A lot of women, and since the overthrow of the Taliban in Afghanistan, a lot more women, thousands of women, I mean, millions of girls are in schools and are getting secondary and high school educations, and thousands have achieved college educations, and they're in the workforce, they're in the government, they're making more and more gains. The present government there, weak as it is in many ways, President Ghani, and the CEO, Abdullah, They're very pro-women's rights, and the government has a good record. They have an active, visible first lady. We've had her come speak to us at USIP. Rula Ghani, Merle has met her, and she's actually out there and visible. Karzai's wife, you never saw Karzai's wife. I heard she was an educated woman. I heard she was a medical doctor, but that could never be proven. He just never let her out of the house or be seen in public, you know. So it's a very different kind of regime than Karzai had.
Okay, this is about choices, what works. Is it better to promote women's self-sufficiency or to get men's acceptance of women? Which focus gets the best results?
I think you have to do both. I think women have to learn how to stand on their own feet. But you also have to get guys to understand how it's in the interest of the family, the village, and the country to have women empowered, standing on their feet economically or politically. We've seen cases of people we've worked with in Afghanistan where the women have developed businesses, and the husband is sometimes like one of the top employees in the business, but under her. And I've actually seen some videos where he said, I'm proud of my wife. She's earned so much money. Our kids are going to school. A daughter's in college, and I'm proud to work for her. But here's the thing. When you go into a country that's gone through this terrible violence, and Westerners tend to do this, first of all, we bring in our own prescriptions too often. We've got to learn what they need locally and adapt to that and do it in their cultural context, in the best parts of their culture, not the worst parts that you hear. And secondly, you go into a place that's in trauma, that's gone through violence, and you start programs all around for women, and the guys are left out. That can cause a lot of resentment. So at some point in these communities, you also have to reach out to the guys. And like we're doing in Ukraine, we're actually doing training separately for displaced women and displaced men and then bringing them together at the end. And the reason we're doing it separately for the men is that we did focus groups in the three cities we were working, and we found out the displaced men are even worse off than the women. They're more isolated. The women at least take the kids to school. They meet other women there. They start to get socialized and become a little bit a part of the community. The guys aren't. The guys are trying to find work. They haven't found work. They have a sense of guilt that they're not out in the occupied zones fighting the Russians. They have a sense of loss of manhood because they haven't found work and they're not supporting their families the right way. They feel isolated, they're frustrated, drinking has gone up, and domestic violence has gone up. So that's why we're doing a gender program and doing some separate training for the women and the men, then after that, bringing them together. So you've got to, in these countries, and especially countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, pay attention to the men, let them know what's going on, the training for the women, have them understand this is not a zero-sum game. If your wife gets some training to give her some skills, this is not taken away from your skills or your manhood. And because they often see it that way, particularly if they're left in the dark and they don't know what's going on with the women. And they think then that the West, all the West cares about is the women. So we've got to bring men into this. They're two parts of society and they have to work together.
Okay, we're unfortunately, I've got a lot more questions as always, but we're going to have to wrap it up. And these are sort of a couple of geographical questions.
Where's my map?
Did you do any work in sub-Saharan Africa with all the civil wars there and here? How about in the context of Israel and Palestine in the West Bank? And finally, what was the most difficult country you've worked in?
Israel, Palestine, we've got a couple of people working on that. They do a lot of things to bring together Israelis and Palestinians. And some of those programs are with women, some are not. I've not been involved in that. Sub-Saharan Africa, our gender group has had a program in South Sudan, because it's the newest country in the world still, I think. And we helped. They wouldn't be a country if it weren't for the United States. And about a year or so into being a new country, they've made an absolute mess of it. The president and the vice president are now enemies of each other, and their political enmity turned into armed conflict. And what's even worse is each is from a different ethnic group. The two big main ethnic groups, so this has become an ethnic war. So it's terrible and it's irresponsible. They should both be brought before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Uh-oh, this is going to be on Maine Public Radio. But it's really sad. So right now we're not going into South Sudan as some of our people were doing, but we've been bringing Sudanese out to places like Rwanda, which is a very safe setting. They've gone through conflict, to say the least, and giving them training there. In this case, we've been together young men and young women from civil society organizations to get them to build their skills, to get them to become leaders, and to get them working together well. And one of the values of bringing them to a country like Rwanda was, in addition to training them in skills, we took them around, my colleagues took them around to various Rwandan museums of the genocide, you know, because close to 1 million people were killed there in the genocide in Rwanda. And had some Rwandans come talk to them about what happened during the genocide, and but more importantly, I think, what do you do in a country after you've gone through such trauma? How do you get a country back on its feet? The economy, the politics, the people, and actually, women have played a very big part in Rwanda. I think they have the highest percentage of women in parliament of any country in the world. It's like 55% or something, and they're big in the economy too. A lot of entrepreneurs and women have been a big part. Of course, a lot of the men are dead. But, you know, I've seen programs where a woman who has become successful has, in this program, become like a sister to a guy who was clearly involved in the genocide, to help him work through the trauma of what he's done and to help to make him a valuable contributing member of society again. This is not to put them into relationships, but just to try to bring, because, you know, that number of people killed, you got a lot of guilty guys out there. And not all of them, only the top leaders, I think, have been punished criminally. So that women are working on reconciliation that way, too, and getting some of these guys to open up and talk about what they've done. And in fact, in this training for for young men on peaceful masculinity in countries like Afghanistan, too, one of the first things you try to do with the guys is to get them to open up, build trust with each other, and talk about what violence has done to them, to their families, to their communities, and to their country. And in Afghanistan, we decided no women in the room. It'll be hard enough to get these guys to open up with each other and start unloading and getting out of what we call the man box, you know, all the things, like you heard the young Serbian saying, all the things are expected of a young man. And my Afghan-American female colleagues particularly felt strongly, you can't have an Afghan woman in the room when we start that dialogue. It'll be men only to get them to open up with each other. So that varies by country. You saw in this case in the Serbian area of Bosnia that there were young women in the room as part of the program. And I've been to see these programs in Bosnia, Serbia, and Croatia, and there were women in the room and women trainers there. But in Afghanistan, we decided you can't do that. It changes the whole atmosphere. It changes the whole dialogue. These guys won't open up.
Well, it's fascinating. It sounds like you've got a lot of countries where you can have a lot still to do. So it's been, I don't know whether that's the good news or the bad news. But anyway, thank you very much, Steve.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Ambassador Stephen Steiner, gender advisor for the U.S. Institute of Peace. If you missed all or part of today's Speaking in Maine, the program is available on our website, mpbn.net, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Woodward.